The City Club of Boise is a nonpartisan forum dedicated to free speech and the open exchange of ideas on issues critical to the Intermountain Northwest. Its motto is, "Things happen when people start talking." You can find information regarding forums, salons, and tours at cityclubofboise.org. The premier sponsor for the City Club is AARP. Annual sponsors include Northwest Nazarene University and the Idaho Humanities Council. This is the City Club's Stimson Award event, and the City Club president is Jeremy Parkinson.
You know, when I was coming in the elevators today, I noticed pictures on the wall. I don't know if you guys saw it, of all the JUMP employees, and it talked about their passions. I believe civility and civil discourse was certainly one of Dottie's passions, and City Club was for sure. I just know that she would have loved an event like this, where we get a chance to celebrate that and celebrate our most recent winner of our award that's named after them. Both Ed and Dottie believed that there was no problem that was too great that it could not be solved by people with open minds and using civil discourse. Some of our past winners of the Dottie and Ed Stimson Award are Dottie and Ed were our first winners in 2009, the Owyhee Initiative in 2011, the second Idaho Citizens Reapportionment Committee in 2012, retired Secretary of State Benya Searcy in 2014, and Congressman Mike Simpson and Idaho Conservation League Director Rick Johnson in 2016. This year we are honored to have Bob Custra and recognize him for his efforts as President of Boise State University to promote civil discourse not only at the university but in our community. It will be our pleasure to hear Dr. Custra talk about the role that universities can play should play in promoting that civility. Welcome to our podium here, our moderator, former City Club President, Marcia Franklin.
We're going to have a moderated discussion between me and, now I have to say, former President Bob Custra after he gives his remarks. But I just want to say again that Dottie would be extremely happy not only at this award recipient, but this gathering as well. It was so important to her. And I know that that Dr. Custra had a special friendship with Dottie, that he would visit her in Seattle when she moved there. So I think it's just wonderful that we're doing this evening. So without further ado, Dr. Bob Custra, recipient of the 2018 Dottie and Ed Stimson Award for Civic Engagement.
Thanks, Marcia. Thank you. Good evening. Well, thank you. I'm deeply honored to be here tonight and to receive this award. It's one of the few opportunities I've had to speak since I left the university as president anyway. I'm still there, and I'm still doing Reader's Corner. But up until June 30th, when I spoke at events like this, I had to be careful as to how I handled myself and what I said. And, of course, I had this wife who would always temper my remarks when I had the good sense to share with her what I was going to say. I'm on my own tonight. All right? Kathy is not here. That's bad news. It's even worse news that she's in the hospital with acute pancreatitis. But the good news is that I'm picking her up right after this event. But she's doing fine. But back to the bad news, she didn't have much to do with my remarks tonight. And I would oftentimes run by her what I might say to a group like yourselves. And that didn't happen this time, since I was running back and forth to the hospital for the last 24 hours, and she was a bit preoccupied with her own health situation. I know one thing that we could agree on easily, and that's the fact that we really loved Ed and Dottie Stimson. They were just really special people. I know not everyone in this room knew them, but there's a good number of you who did, and I won't go on and on because you know how special they were. But what great citizens of this community, citizens of this nation. I mean, Ed was a nationally known aviation executive and so knowledgeable about transportation. And Dottie, of course, the founder of this club, I mean, she meant so much to all of us. We met them not long after we arrived, and from that moment on, we were just really good friends. And as Marcia said, we even had a chance to visit with Dottie when she moved to Seattle, and she was really in this unbelievable back brace at the time, but it was like she didn't leave Boise for more than 5 minutes. She was keeping up with everything that was going on here. She knew all the issues. She was deeply engaged. It was just amazing to see somebody who was still so in love with this very special place we call home. So that makes this honor even more special. The City Club, it's interesting for me. I had a good friend who founded the City Club of Chicago. And back in the day when he did so, he would enlist me to help gin up the crowd and get people to the event. And half the time he'd have me speak. And so when I got to Boise and learned that you folks already had this City Club, it's like, wow, I get to do this again, all over again. And I think more than anything else, the City Club is to me a staple of American democracy. It's absolutely the linchpin which we depend on when it comes to a functioning democracy and giving people the opportunity to be heard and discuss and debate and differ. Learn how to disagree without being disagreeable. That really is the sum and substance of the City Club as I know it. I was thinking today about some of those old lectures I used to give in American Politics 101 when I took the students back to the 4th century BC and we'd talk about Athenian democracy in the days when 6,000 Greeks, male citizens I might add, sorry about that, but in any event, 6,000 Greeks would gather to make policy, and they'd hold referenda in those days. Well, obviously, our democracy today is much different from what we learned originally from the Greeks, thanks to enormous and powerful interest groups and political parties and the unbelievable overriding influence of money in our elections. Representative government today is a lot different than those days when they were taking the roll call of 6,000 people to find out how they stood on a referendum. Although I must say we did have a couple of some referenda here in Idaho this last time, so that's good news. But the fact of the matter is that we live in a very different world today. And sure, it's a functioning democracy, but it's one that requires a great deal of attention and care. And again, I think the City Club can play such an incredible role as far as that's concerned. The one thing that I find so different about our work here in Boise compared to other places I've lived in Kentucky and Minnesota and Illinois is the lopsided nature of government here in the sense that it's so overwhelmingly one-party control. Here in Boise, whether you're talking about the city government or whether you're talking about state government, it's just really simply one way of doing business. I mean, at the state level, you have every constitutional officer in both houses of the legislature from one party and a handful of people who are the loyal opposition, and it's extremely difficult for them to be too much the loyal opposition because, of course, when it comes time to get your bill through a committee, you'll never do it if you've been yelling and screaming about the injustices of the other party. And that, it seems to me, is one of the great challenges we have in the state of Idaho, is how do we get a balanced government? How do we get balanced perspectives of what's going on in our state and in our cities if we don't, in fact, have some association or organization that works as an extra organization, you might say, that brings people together, and as you saw from the video, does this incredible job of giving not only public officials, but opinion makers and other folks who are leaders in their community the opportunity to sound off, to really sound off. And I am going to talk a little bit about civility here in a second, but my concern about civility is that we never let it be used as an excuse to shut up or quiet down, okay? I really am concerned. I remember going to an event right here in town a year or so ago when the representative officials were at the head of the table or at the head of the, up on the microphone, and they all spoke. and there were Democrats and Republicans, and yet I walked away thinking, well, it's easy for one of those parties to be civil because they get their way in almost everything they do. And in one particular case of a constitutional officer that will go unnamed, I mean, I've lived in states where he would have been removed from office. And in Boise, the work of his office, or the problems of his office, went virtually unnoticed. A few articles in the paper, but no action taken, and nobody dealing with it seriously. And so the checks and balances that this nation needs to have a functioning democracy are sometimes missing in the state of Idaho. And if it can't happen in the legislature or in among the state constitutional officers, then it's going to have to happen someplace else. And that has to be an organization like the City Club. And the idea of speaking out and speaking forthrightly and frankly is absolutely critical. I remember telling students one day, we were talking about this business of civility, and they said, well, define it. And I said, well, let me tell you what it's not. It's not the title of Al Franken's book, Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot. Okay? That's an ad hominem attack on a person. Now, if they said Rush Limbaugh is wrong, claiming Barack Obama wasn't born in the United States, hey, you're on. That's a civil criticism of the man and his position. But, and by the way, I did run that line past Kathy, and she said, what's wrong with the first way you said it? She didn't have any problem with the original Al Franken title. Actually, I don't either, but I was trying to make the point to students that we can't argue with ad hominem remarks, which, for all you Latin scholars know it means to the person instead of to the argument. And in a sense, I think that's what we have to do with the City Club, and that's what the City Club's been doing for years. There's no question about that. The other thing I might comment on about Idaho is that it's like Boise. And of course, you know, I came from a much different environment in Illinois and Kentucky, where it's a very different brand of politics, and it's pretty rough. And here, you know, Kathy and I call it Boise Nice. Because I don't know, I mean, there's downsides that I've already stated about, you know, this one-party government, but there's enormous advantages when people treat each other with dignity and respect. And you find that here in Idaho. You just can't let that get in the way of the criticism that public officials deserve when they're either not doing their job or not doing it right or not doing it the way you think it ought to be done. But I do think the culture here is very different and in many ways very favorable to the kinds of things you're doing at the City Club, because no matter where you are, it seems you are allowed to have your point of view. Now, I have some practice with this business of deciding when it's appropriate and when it's not appropriate to sound off, all right, or speak out. And you might remember that one of those times was when I gave a campus fall address after President Trump was elected. And, of course, my life, to some extent, not all of my life, but a fairly significant part of my presidential life changed the day Donald Trump was elected president. And I think sometimes when I tell people that, they're like, really? What are you talking about? But, I mean, whether it was students or faculty or staff, as he went on commenting on people in America and what they stood for and who they were, more and more students were upset and concerned, and including faculty, expected me to be the guy that would speak out on a daily basis against all this stuff, right? Well, when you're living in a state, getting back to that one-party control, when you're living in a state that has this enormous Republican advantage and there's a Republican president, you really have to weigh how often you can get by with that. So many times I'm sure I disappointed the faculty and staff that I wasn't sounding off. I remember one day I was sitting in my office early in the morning and some faculty member came into the office hysterical because there was a poster on the wall somewhere that had the word Nazi on it. And I thought, is this what they call safe spaces. What's going on here? But I had to stop and think now, how upset should we be about a poster that has something on it that we find despicable and reprehensive, but which may just fall under some category of free speech, whether we like it or not? And so my entire presidency, especially those last 2 years, was spent trying to figure out a way to balance that all off. Well, by the time Raul Labrador said that we shouldn't be worried just about white nationalists, we should be worried about black nationalists, and I'm looking around trying to figure out when's the last time I ever heard of a black nationalist, I had to go back to the 1960s, I had to look it up in Wikipedia, and I finally found some guy who called himself a black nationalist. And so I said that at the podium that day, and boy, did I catch heat for that, you know? But the fact of the matter is, in fact, if you remember, the greatest heat, I won't call it heat really, it was funny, is that he suggested that it's time for me to retire. Well, he was almost right, okay? He was a year or so off, but I was already thinking way ahead of his remarks. I guess the only reason I make that point is that's what I mean by speaking out. I mean, I know that a good number of you probably have businesses or something where you're going to have to be careful, depending on what crowd you're in or what company you're in, as to what you can say. But this city club has to be forthright, and it has to be as direct as you can possibly be, as candid as you can possibly be, with those who are running our government or running anything else for that matter. And I think that's what's so great about having a city club and why it's so important. I want to mention just a couple of things about our students. I've got a whole list of the things that we've done at Boise State that are so cool, but I want to just give you a couple of examples. First of all, there's civility initiatives going on across the campus. 4, 5, or 6 of them are here in my notes, and we're running out of time, so I'm not going to go into those. But there's one or two that I think are really incredible. Back in 2011... These students, and I think it was student government, but I'm not even so sure, they started something called Vox Populi. And that may not be the correct Latin pronunciation, but it's voice of the people. And basically, they bring people to campus. And one day they brought Jonah Goldberg and Peter Beinart. Now, you all might not be familiar with those two characters, but Jonah Goldberg is a card-carrying conservative. His latest book is something like Suicide of the West, How Identity Politics, Nationalism, Tribalism, and Populism Are Ruining American Democracy. Peter Beinart had a book out at the time that was something like Liberals Are the Only People Who Can Stop Terrorism. And that was an entire book. And then he had a book out called the Icarus Syndrome. And that was, of course, about foreign policy and how so many of our presidents have gone wrong, and it had a liberal slant to it. So these two guys come to campus. I just show up because the students invited me, which I think is just so cool about Boise State students, that they figure this stuff out for themselves, and even today they're figuring this stuff out. And here's Peter and Jonah. Jonah, by the way, he may be a card-carrying conservative, but he is an anti-Trumper all the way, all right? There is nothing, if you follow him in various places, I think he's on MSNBC sometimes, or at least CNN. But Jonah, in every way, got up there and gave the conservative bent on everything there was. This is 2011, right? And then Peter Beinart got up and did the liberal thing. At the outset of the debate, they explained that they're friends, that they hang out together in Washington. And that is amazing. By doing that, the entire evening, everybody just kind of let themselves down like, oh, well, then this is going to be okay. And students in the audience, including me, were given this opportunity to see these two guys really go at it. I mean, they really went at it. But always in the spirit of friendship and respect for each other. I thought it was such a great moment for Boise State. We also have something that a handful of students and one of our professors came up with called the Boise State Civilian Research Network. And they created this thing out of whole cloth. And basically, They describe it as a way to bring the city and the university together to build a more effective civic infrastructure. And I attended two or three of their meetings. They invited me to, would you mind coming? And I was sitting in the back of the room. I had no role whatsoever. It was absolutely amazing to watch these students who came from the far left, from the far right, from in the middle, all sitting down together. And this guy who ran it, he was the general in charge. I mean, it was amazing to see the way he would dictate who got to speak and when. And if anybody dared speak when you weren't recognized to speak, you were gaveled down immediately by this student and told, uncivil behavior, uncivil behavior. And the whole afternoon went like that. There's a half dozen examples of our students and faculty who have come together to do that. Our School of Public Service itself is the creation of an entity that's to bring people together in the good of the public service, to train people for the public service, but also to engage them in much the same way as we do with the City Club. So I'm very proud of the role that Boise State University has played over the years. And the most important message I can give you is that I had nothing to do with almost every one of these stories I could tell you about these initiatives. These spring up from the faculty. They spring up from students. They demonstrate that it's an amazing opportunity for folks, for students, to become engaged in a way that you just wouldn't think they'd be able to do or be willing to do. Anyway, with that said, I thank you again for this opportunity. I look forward to joining Marcia and talking about some things that are on your mind. But believe me, it's a real honor to live here in Boise, and it's been an unbelievable honor to serve as the president of Boise State for 15 years. And knowing what Dottie Stimson and Ed did for this community, I'm truly humbled by the fact that you would pass this award on to me this year. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
I'm delighted to be here to moderate this discussion with Dr. Custra. And as I mentioned, please feel free to fill out a question card and raise your hand, and someone will bring it to me. Well, I'll just start right out and ask you, with your interest in all of this and the overview you just gave the audience about Idaho and Idaho politics, why did you not consider running for office in this state?
Well, this is one of those answers that I could never give prior to June 30th, Marcia, so I'm glad you're asking it now. And the only reason I say that is because, you know, the moderate Republican in me back in the day was really moderate. In fact, before I was a moderate Republican, I worked for a liberal Republican. That word is not even allowed anymore. Actually, the word moderate's not allowed anymore. But Senator Charles H. Percy from Illinois, who was in the Senate long time. I worked for him, and he had an enormous influence on my career and actually helped me with my career. But, you know, number one, the answer I always give is been there, done that. The answer Kathy gives is different. It's like, you should check his voting record out. He could get elected to nothing in the state of Idaho, okay? You know? I mean, in 1981, a friend of mine in Chicago, I don't even remember whether he's a Democrat or Republican, had a bill that was a bill that said, if you're being considered for tenure at a public university, they cannot take sexual orientation into account. Now doesn't that sound absurd in 2018? But let me tell you something, in 1981, that was a big deal. Okay? I decided to vote for that bill. There were 14 of us voting for that bill. I think I wound up being the only Republican voting for the bill. And if that wasn't enough, because I was a very unseasoned freshman legislator, I decided to get up and speak on the bill. Now, it's one thing to vote for a bill, But when you speak on it, they've got that in writing forever, okay? And when I ran for the U.S. Senate in 1996, there were Christian churches who had spread through all of southern Illinois that I was gay because I voted for that bill in 1981. Now, how's that going to work in Idaho? I don't know. I mean, I know this is 2018 in the United States of America. I'm not sure it's 2018 in the state of Idaho, all right? And therefore, I don't think I'd get very far. That's only the beginning of a long list of votes that wouldn't work for me in this state. But I'll tell you right now, the other one is gun control. You know, Reagan was shot on one day. I was the co-sponsor of an anti-handgun bill. And, you know, where's that going to get you in the state of Idaho?
Well, I could probably play a little devil's advocate yeah. here and say, why didn't she even try? But I will. Yeah. I think your point is well taken, and you probably could move more stones and have more action on a university campus in the end than potentially in politics. You could do more things. In the position that you were in. I'm curious to know, since this is about civil discourse, what was role modeled for you growing up? What in regards to conflict and conflict resolution? How did your parents or whoever you grew up with teach you about that?
My parents were completely apolitical. They were Democrats growing up on the north end of St. Louis, a working class environment. Most of my class didn't go on to college. They were, you know, going right to the workplace. I did have an uncle who was an alderman of the city council in St. Louis. And he would come over on Sundays and have a drink with my father. And they would talk about politics. It was the only time my father ever talked about politics. And I was so impressed with this guy. You know, he was a stately gentleman that looked like he could have been a U.S. senator to me. He was alderman from the city of St. Louis. And I used to think when I was a kid, that's pretty cool. I like the way he represents his aldermanic district and his ward, as we called them. And that was probably one thing. And then when I was a senior in high school, I was chosen by the chief of police. The Rotary Club always has students go to the Rotary Clubs. And I was chosen by the chief of police to join him at the Rotary luncheon. And they picked me up at school. The chief of police picked me up in his black car. And it was like, wow, this is really a big deal. And we went down to downtown St. Louis, and I had a chance to meet all these bigwigs. And I can remember that making a significant impression on me. So by the time I got to high school, or in high school, you know, I ran for every office I could think of and was president of the student council. And then when I was a freshman, I was president of the freshman class. So I was pretty much headed into elective office wherever it was. And then I got into teaching and was, in a sense, I was so focused and fascinated with teaching that I really didn't think too much about politics. And it's kind of accident that I even got into politics because I was working for this legislator doing research for him. And one day he came into the office and he said, you know, I'm going to retire. If you want my job, I'll support you. And that's how I got into the Illinois House of Representatives. I was a carpetbagger because I had only lived in the district for 2 years. And I thought that was going to keep me out. But I was able to get enough support in the community. We went door to door in those days. Flashlight, you know, on the precinct roll, and just knocked on every door, told them who I was, what I wanted to do. I spent 10 years going door to door when I was in the legislature.
So you met a lot of people doing that, and obviously in representing your district. Did you have a mentor or role model who taught you about dealing with dissension and dealing with views other than your own, and how to remain calm and mediate that?
Well, I'm not so sure he succeeded at remaining calm.
Okay.
That's another story. But I think Chuck Percy was an incredible guy. 29 years old, president of Bell & Howell. 29. Amazing. He was out of sync with his party. He was a Republican back in the day, even then, when the Republicans were more conservative than he was. And he would, I mean, we'd spend hours listening to people just beat him up, you know, people who disagreed with him. And sometimes it wasn't pretty. And I was really impressed at how his demeanor could always remain constant and how he could bring people along or win people, even though they didn't agree with him. He'd find another issue, you know, to work into the conversation. And before you know it, they were talking about something that was not what the dissenters came to discuss with him. And I saw that so often. I think he's the guy more than anybody else that played a positive influence. Now, I had a lot of negative influences, and it's a good thing I didn't follow them, because a good number of them went to the federal penitentiary. Okay? And the guy I went to work for as the administrative assistant to the Speaker of the House, I ran the Illinois House of Representatives for him, and he went to the federal pen. And I didn't have the slightest idea that he was taking money under the, you know, he was taking $500 bills from lobbyists and getting caught. And off he goes. And I didn't have a clue. But there were a group of us in those early days when we were staffers for the legislature. There's four of us, and one's no longer with us. But we, every now and then, we reconnect, and we talk about those days. And what we always said was, these guys we're working for are all crooks. You know, almost the entire leadership of the House Republican leadership were, in one way or another, taking money, or if it wasn't taking money outrightly, it was allowing lobbyists to have their way with them. Okay? It might have been legal, but it never set right with us that these guys would just simply walk up to a lobbyist and say something like, you know, I can be for your bill, but I got a campaign to run. How much is it going to cost? Or, you know, what do you... And so we got together and we would say, maybe the day will come when we'll get a chance to do this and we'll do it a different way. And I have a good friend who's a retired federal judge in Chicago, and he and I, we go back and forth on email all the time. He and I are always comparing notes and saying, isn't it amazing? We did it. You know, we made it out of there. We made it out of there doing it right and without anybody after us, the way a lot of these guys, yeah.
I'm going to just ask one more question before we move into some of your questions. Thank you very much. What do you see as the role of higher education, be that a community college or a four-year institution, in promoting civil dialogue? There was a big report that came out in 2012 from the Association of American Colleges and Universities called A Crucible Moment, College Learning and Democracy's Future. Very long report that suggested dire consequences if we don't do something at the higher education level to work on these issues with students.
Yeah.
What do you see is its role?
Well, you know, this is really where I show how confused I am when it comes to my politics, because, you know, I'm that moderate. They said one time, a friend of mine was in Congress, and he told me one time, he said, you know, I'm a moderate. I'm in the middle of the road, and most accidents occur in the middle of the road. And that's the way I felt when I lost the Senate primary to a very conservative Republican. But, you know, getting back to Jonah Goldberg, I mean, his book, Suicide of the West, I hope to do it on Reader's Corner. And a lot of that book I agree with. And I don't want to offend anybody here in the audience, but the fact is, when it comes to what colleges and universities need to do, sure, on the 30,000-foot level, they have to be open and engaged in civil discourse. But if the truth be known, civil discourse in the classroom and outside of the classroom is pretty much of a one-way street at colleges and universities in America today. If you're of the liberal persuasion, that's what you're going to hear about 80% of the time. And I don't care where you are. I mean, except maybe one of those religious schools that obviously have a very, very conservative bent. And I think the greatest challenge universities and colleges have, especially state universities and colleges, is giving students an opportunity to hear both sides. And getting both sides these days can be tough. During my presidency, I had a number of occasions where I had complaints brought to me by faculty, students whose faculty members just really violated the principle of fairness and listening to both sides, and got all hysterical about an issue and didn't give students the opportunity. And I think that's the reason why they play right into the hands of the far right, by the way. I mean, that's what really angers me about my liberal colleagues in the university, is that by shutting off discussion that is fair and balanced, I hate to use that word, but real fair and balanced, let's put it that way, they really set themselves up. They set us all up. They set universities and colleges up and presidents and everybody else who thinks they're fair-minded and objective, because that's when the far right pounces on you and really, really takes advantage of you.
And we did have two questions related to that, at least two. I haven't been able to get through all of them, but someone did ask, please talk about college students blocking speakers who represent the right wing.
Yeah,
and I can tell you feel that that's not...
Yeah, it makes no sense whatsoever. We've had Ben Shapiro either came or almost came to campus. I don't even remember. We were all over that one, like, look, you know, this guy has a right to be here. Most of us aren't going to like what he has to say, but we've got to figure out a way to give him the space to say it. We also have to help our faculty and staff especially, and our students, understand that just because somebody's yelling and screaming at you and calling you something is not cause to kick them out of a room. You know, you're going to have to listen, and then you respond to them, to the argument, not to the person. And boy, that's tough. I mean, a lot of our students are learning, they're maturing, and they're angry, and they don't like when somebody calls them a name that they've avoided most of their lives. But it's the way life is in the real world, and they better get used to it now, because it ain't going away in the workplace.
Well, that's what I was thinking, you know, that colleges are maybe the place where you're going to get that kind of critical thinking, critical thinking education before you go out into the world. Because, did you ever worry that there was, you know, going to be some sort of incident? Because there have been on campuses. How do you, what are the brass tacks, in presenting both sides but not having violence happen? Do you vet all the speakers? I mean, does somebody say to you, look, we're thinking of bringing so-and-so?
No.
Does it go all the way up to your office and you say, no, that's just way too controversial?
No, we
or
don't.
You just let it?
Yeah, we don't vet them.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember a situation where somebody came into my office and said, okay, can we have this speaker or not? No, we don't do that. I just always felt like if it's a speaker who, you know, is legitimately on campus to give a speech, we have a series, a very conservative series on our campus called the Brandt Lectures. And the Brandt Lectures, every year, they bring in somebody who is very conservative. Now, I have to admit that you can get more conservative than the people the Brandt Lecture brings in, for sure. You can get wacky on the far right. They don't bring in those kinds of folks. They bring in constitutional scholars who have a different way of looking at the Constitution than somebody who's liberal would have. But that event is a good example of Boise State honoring all parts of the political spectrum. If the truth be known, however, that happens to be the only conservative one, and on a fairly regular basis, I think, we hear the more liberal side.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Did you discontinue the distinguished lecture for a little bit because there were complaints that it was just too liberal? It seems like there were a couple years where it didn't happen as you were reformulating.
I was never a party to the decision to discontinue it, and it's going today. So, I don't know of any decision that was made along those lines.
Well, here's somebody writing from the opposite point of view. In the days of Antifa and our current administration saying that they are proud to be nationalist, which is basically giving the far-right extremist groups a voice, how can we as a nation have civil discourse? So there's There's some who feel that the liberals are getting too much of their voice across, or points across, and others who feel like we're...
Well, again, I mean,
I'm optimistic that we can.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at our campus, you know, you can find all points of view, obviously, and even though sometimes I think our faculty and staff may knee-jerk to their chosen position, I think for the most part, we do at Boise State give people the opportunity to say what they want to say. But it's never easy, and you know, people come to us from all over this country with all kinds of family backgrounds and experiences and political leanings and affiliations, and we have to respect those. I think for the most part, the so-called administration has. It's sometimes when you get down into the classroom where it really does get tough. One of the things I've always reminded my students, I always talk about Harry Truman. Harry Truman once said he got frustrated with these economic reports that come out all the time, because every time you get an economic report, you know, the guy would say, well, on the one hand, we've got good news for you. But on the other hand, and one day he said, you know, what I'm looking for is a one-handed economist. You know, somebody who's not going to be dilly-dallying around with it's this good news and it's bad news. And when I used to do my teaching evaluations, when they used to come in when I was at the University of Illinois and Northwestern, I'd read these evaluations and they'd say, well, it was a good class, but he was too liberal for me. And the same course, they'd say, it was a good class, but he was too conservative for me. And what I got out of that was that I did kind of the old Harry Truman thing. I didn't do the one hand, I did the both hands. And I think that's really what we have to do as faculty, is we have to recognize that when you stand before students, you owe them every position there is on that political spectrum. If they want to ask you where you stand, hey, you get to tell them. You know, but to make it look like there's only one way the world turns is most unfortunate, and it happens way too often.
When you look back on your tenure as president, are there any comments that you made that you regret, that you feel were uncivil?
I can tell you the one you're all thinking of.
Yeah, well,
Yeah. No, that's the most civil comment I've ever made, and I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why.
It might have something to do
is
with
that was. Let me see if I got that right. Is that? Oh, they didn't say it. They just asked me if. Yeah, this is something Kathy weighed in on today. You know, I was next to her in the hospital with her, and I said something about, you know, incivility, and she said, "You mean like nasty and inebriated?" And I said, "Uh-uh. No, I don't mean that at all." I said, at the time that was said, the fact of the matter is that Boise State fans visiting the University of Idaho for a football game were treated horribly. They were keyed in their cars when they parked. I mean, keyed along the side of the cars. There was way too much drinking. There still is, if you ask me. In fact, ask the parents of the students who come to Boise State, and they'll tell you, well, no, I didn't want to do that because I was drinking up there. Okay? So the fact of the matter is, there was a serious problem. After I made those remarks, the president at the time, Duane Nellis, did two or three things, two of which I think I can remember. He cordoned off the parking lot and put security guards there so cars wouldn't get keyed anymore. He eliminated Boise State Hate Week. What was that about? Boise State Hate Week. Give me a break, okay? And there was one other thing he did. What happened with that is that Brian Murphy, who was with the Statesman at the time, he decided to gin this one up and turn it into a Custer hates the alumni of Idaho, okay? And before you know it, it was all about that. But to this day, I'd say that all over again, and we got action, and there's not a problem. The main reason there's not a problem is we don't play them anymore, okay? Now that I'm gone, maybe that'll happen again. But I want to say while I'm on this subject that, you know, Marty Peterson and I, by the way, are buddies. And Marty Peterson and I, by the way, are buddies because we believe that each of the universities ought to have governing boards. And I believe the University of Idaho, as much as, if not more so, than Boise State, would have benefited enormously with its own governing board over the last 15 years I've been here. And I don't know whether this is going anywhere, but I just want folks to know I'm not here to beat up on the University of Idaho. I want to see the University of Idaho pick the very best president they can. I want to see them be successful, and I hope to see them someday have their own governing board where they'll have the kind of support they deserve instead of. I'll leave it at that.
So,
it's nice not being the president anymore, isn't it? Get to say what you damn well please.
So, have there ever been any comments that you've made that you wish to that you would have dialed back?
I really can't. The Labrador comment is one that I knew when I said it what I was doing. I had never said anything about a public official that I can remember anyway at a podium where it would be quotable. And I did that because I always felt like, as president, it was not my job to publicly state where I stood on political positions or anything like that. And I felt very strongly about that. I kept my Republican credentials, so to speak, my primary voting affiliation, throughout my 15 years, and I still am a Republican. And even though Kathy switched over to independent, I told her, I want to be one of them so I can figure out a way to get them back into the middle, and I don't think, there's enough Democrats around to take care of the Democratic Party, but I want to be one of the Republicans who helps move them back again. I don't think I'm going to be able to do much on that. These elections 2 weeks ago may have more to do with that than anything else.
So, are you on Facebook now that you're...
I'm not on Facebook, but I have a Twitter account. And I'm dangerous.
What do you...
At Bob Custra. Okay? I have a puny number of followers, so I really would appreciate it. Just for the hell of it, even if you don't want to learn anything, I retweet all the articles I can find, and most of them are pretty predictable these days as to what's going on in this country, and you can imagine. And every now and then I'll add my own comment to a retweet. Kathy tells me to cut that out. I'm enjoying tweeting. I don't do it a lot. Some of these folks do it like it's a living. But every now and then it's just impossible not to retweet something that somebody said so perfectly about this character in presidency right now that that's probably most of my tweets, if the truth be known.
Well, what's your sense, about how all the social media plays into incivility? Because certainly, there was bullying when we were all growing up, but it would be like a crank call or somebody throw a snowball out the window or mean words to your face. But now you can do it semi-anonymously on social media, and I don't, your students must have a lot of that happening.
Right.
Do you think it's a negative?
Yeah,
force?
I've seen and heard that, and you're right. It adds a whole new challenge to the issue of civility. And, I've actually talked to some students about what they put on Twitter, for example, and remind them that it's all there for people to see down the road, whether it's Facebook or Twitter, and you better be very careful. And I think in our orientation sessions, we talk to them about that with their parents in the room, that you better watch your social media opportunities because they can haunt you when you go to get an internship. They can haunt you when you go get a job. But it's a work in progress, I think, as far as universities and colleges are concerned. We haven't mastered it, and we still have a lot of students out there who like to pop off when they really ought to be more careful in what they say and do.
How did the legislature's decision about guns on campus affect the tenor of everything?
It was tough. We all were disappointed, number one, and chagrined that they would do that. And I appeared on in committee And we had a number of other people appear in committee and testify. And I know for the students it was frustrating because they felt like no one was really listening to them, like it was preordained. Everybody knew what was coming out of the committee. Meanwhile, back at the campus, there were faculty who were visibly upset about what would happen in their classrooms, and they became concerned about their safety and their students' safety. I have to say that in the last couple of years, I haven't heard much about that issue, and it seems like it's settled down. I don't want to speak for faculty and staff. I can't do that. But it seems to me anyway that the fear that was originally expressed has really quieted down, and people are living with it. And that may be because there have been, to the best of my knowledge, no incidents of any kind. Probably the tougher part was having to make the decision to put the screening at the stadium, because we, you know, didn't know what people were going to think of that. But that's worked rather smoothly, I think, and they do a great job out there of getting people through in a minimum amount of time.
We do have a question from a student here. What are ways that I can get civil discourse discussions started at my high school?
Well, I think the first thing you do is talk to some of the students you hang out with and ask them if they would like to just sit around someday after school and have a conversation and pick a topic, whatever it might be, whether it's politics, whether it's economics, whether it's healthcare, whatever it might be. Just get a group of students together. If you talk to some of the people in the room who are in book clubs, you will find that they're friends who decided one day they want to talk to one another about something other than whatever they talk about at dinner. So they decide, let's read a book and then we'll talk about that book. But you don't really need a book to have a civil conversation with your friends. And so you just start out with three or four, hang around after school in the cafeteria and start talking. And you know what I bet will happen? Before you know it, you'll get somebody else coming up and saying, what are you guys doing here? What's going on? Can I sit down and listen? And before you know it, you've got a group of students who could formally organize, not unlike our Boise State Civility Research Network. Those were just students who lived around each other in the Honors College and decided one day, we want to talk to each other. And boy, by the time they finished, they brought students in from every place on the political spectrum. I think you could do the same thing. And I'm delighted that you're asking the question.
Maybe even invite somebody that you don't know or you disagree with that you know you disagree with.
Yeah.
See if they'll come.
Right.
Do that. What's your biggest failure and how bad does it hurt and what did you learn from it?
My biggest failure? Wow. Well, you know, when you've been around for 15 years, you have to appoint a lot of people to positions. And you hope through search committees and processes that they're all going to turn out great, and they don't. And sometimes you make a misjudgment on character or competence, and when you do, you have to do something about it. And over the years, I've had a few of those where I thought somebody was going to work out so perfectly, and between me and the search committee who was working with the search consultant, it was all going to work out. And I have to say, it's really tough these days. Maybe it's this way everywhere. I'm not in the line of work that the rest of you are in. But in higher education, it's getting almost impossible to get an objective assessment of a person. Everybody wants to kind of hold back. They don't want to talk. Search consultants do their best to drag it out of you. But it's really difficult. And consequently, you'll get people that, you know, you thought based on the references worked, but they didn't. And, you know, that's a challenge.
Mm-hmm. And along those lines, another person writes, if you were on the search committee for the new BSU president, what would you be looking for in that new leader?
You know, we had dinner last night with somebody, or the other night, with somebody who asked the same question. And we ended up having like a 45-minute discussion about it. So I'll try to get that down to 2 minutes or less. I think today in higher education, in university work, the importance of having someone who understands the external affairs of the university is critical, and who has the skills and competencies to deal with those.
Explain to people what external affairs.
Yeah, so in other words, communicating, having the emotional intelligence to deal with a legislator, a member of the media, a donor, a parent who is brand new to Boise State. Each of those people have to be dealt with very differently. One-on-one, look them in the eye and talk to them about their experience, and you care about only one thing in the world, and that's making their experience successful. Or you're asking something of a legislator, and you have to do that. Too often, when presidents are chosen, they come from lines of work in the university, and I'm not going to say where. They come from lines of work in the university where all they're doing is inside work, and they don't have a clue on what it's like to work with this external community. And I think what makes it so difficult for some university presidents is that adjustment period. Some people can actually adjust and learn on the job, and within a year they've got it down. Others never figure it out, and they usually end up being moved on. And so as both the University of Idaho and Boise State do its search, they really need to focus on the fact that it's not necessarily the smartest man or woman in the room, or on the campus, and it's not necessarily the person who has been in this office that really is all about academics, but it better be somebody who better understands the relationship of the university to the rest of the constituencies he or she deals with. And those constituencies, one person identified those as 28 different constituencies a university president has to deal with. And you better be able to drill down on that candidate's resume and experiences and find someone who has all of that and then can prove also that they've made three of the most difficult decisions of their lives, and at the end, they were successful decisions. That's what I would do if I was looking for a president.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, and congratulations.
Thanks, Marcia. Thanks for doing this. Appreciate it.
This award.
Thank you. Thank you.
For the radio audience, you've been listening to Dr. Bob Krestra. He was the president of Boise State University for 15
right.
years.
Yep.
And he is the 2018 recipient of the City Club of Boise's Dottie and Ed Stimson Award for Civic Engagement. Thank you, and here's the award to be presented.
Thank you, Bob. I know we all appreciated that. With that, we thank you, Bob, and I've got the award here I want to give you.
Yeah, that's cool. Thank you. Thank you all very much.
You've been listening to the City Club of Boise, a public forum discussing important issues of the day in a nonpartisan, civil manner. The next City Club event is on Monday, the 10th of December, at which Jim Everett and Doug Brigham, co-presidents for the College of Idaho, discuss exploring a new model of collaborative leadership at a challenging time in education. Find more on that event at cityclubofboise.org or by calling 208-371-2221. Connect on Facebook and Twitter by searching City Club of Boise.